Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Christopher Columbus's voyage to the New World change the course of human history? While his 1492 search for a trade route to Asia proved fruitless, the exchange of cultures and commodities between the Americas, Europe, and the Far East begun by Columbus touched off a radical reshaping of cultures, economies, and landscapes that continues to this day. Charles C. Mann is a correspondent for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired magazines. He joins us now to talk about his book, which is available these days in paperback. It's called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Charles, welcome to Think.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here.
I love thinking about the fact that in his wildest dreams, Columbus and his men, they could not have imagined the impact they would have on the world 6 centuries later.
Absolutely not. I mean, they were pretty ambitious, but you could say that what Columbus did far outstripped his wildest dreams, for better and for worse.
Yeah, and we're so aware of the movement of people to parts of the planet from where their ancestors originated, but we don't always recognize the impact of other transplanted species, from germs to bugs to crops and trees.
Yeah, 200 million years ago, as we learn in school, the Earth consisted of a single giant landmass, and scientists call Pangaea, and geological forces broke it up, which meant that for tens of millions of years, the various parts of the world, the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere, were separate, and they developed completely different suites of plants and animals. And what Columbus did, in effect, from a biological point of view, was to bring together the continents. He recreated Pangaea, and huge numbers of creatures from over there came over here, huge numbers of creatures from over here went over there, and it was an ecological convulsion. It was the biggest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs, and it was set off by this one voyage.
Talk about the difference between the sort of separate evolutions on in the Americas as opposed to Eurasia. What did we not have here that existed elsewhere and vice versa?
Well, by a quirk of history, there were very few domesticable animals over here. And that's why Native Americans didn't have horses, they didn't have cows, they didn't have goats, they didn't have sheep, they didn't have chickens, they didn't have any of the familiar domestic animals that we see today, or any analogs to them. And the animals that were here, like bison and so forth, are notoriously undomesticable. They're very, very, even with modern techniques, they're very, very difficult to domesticate. And the reason that was important, not only because it meant that they didn't have draft animals and beasts of burden and sources of milk and so forth, but also because people in Europe and Asia and Africa had spent, you know, however many thousands of years living next to these animals, you know, living in their barns, essentially. What this means is that every now and then, an animal disease, as scientists say, jumps the species barrier and becomes a human disease. We've recently seen this with bird flu, right, which is a bird disease that recently has acquired the ability to infect humans. And most of the great killers in human history, smallpox, measles, influenza, and so forth, are all animal diseases that jumped the species barrier and became human diseases. And as a result, none of those diseases and those organisms or any of their analogs existed in the Americas. And so one of the first impacts that happened when Columbus crossed the Earth is that inadvertently he brought over all these bacteria and microbes that swept across the Americas.
Yeah, and people, the populations had no chance to develop any kind of natural immunity through evolution. So what happened over hundreds or even thousands of years in Europe, it was just a matter of decades in this country.
Right. It's as if you think of all the, you know, the terrible suffering and death that smallpox and measles and influenza, you know, created in Europe and Asia and Africa over the tens of thousands of years before the invention of antibiotics. It's as if all that suffering were compressed into about a century and a half in the Americas. And the result was that somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of the people in the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in human history. And it was like absolutely nothing before or since. And it goes a long way to explaining why small groups of Europeans, you know, usually very poorly equipped at the end of very long supply chains, could survive and even thrive in landscapes that were completely unlike anything they had seen before.
And they could survive and thrive. And then the native populations that were nearby often didn't have the strength or the manpower to fight back.
Yeah. And what there's a striking pattern it shows is that when Europeans came to the Americas and tried to establish themselves before these diseases natives would often let them stay for a little while because they were interested in trade, but then they would kick them out. And you see this happening time and time again. There are, you know, 20 or more efforts by Europeans to settle in the eastern part of, of North America before Jamestown, and they were all repelled. They all failed. Then the diseases start coming in, and almost all the European efforts are successful. And it, you know, to me, it seems like it makes the difference. You know, that's the vital difference. Europeans had certain advantages in technology, but they're more than canceled out by the fact that they're so distant and from their from their base in Europe, and they had such small numbers that just masses of Indians could and did push them out.
At what point in history, Charles, did Europeans realize they were disease vectors, as opposed to, you know, it's sort of accidental and you come in contact with people and suddenly they get sick?
Well, you have to realize that at this time, there was no germ theory of disease anywhere in the world. That doesn't come until the latter part of the 19th century. And instead, for Europeans, as for native people, diseases were a manifestation of the will of supreme being. And they come, they go, and it's under God's control. And this was common understanding by people around the world then, that they were supernatural forces. And so when Europeans saw this, they come, diseases happen, these native people die. For them, this is a manifestation of the will of God. And the terrible thing is that for the people on the other side, it was something, they thought something was similar.
Yeah. And the other thing that makes sense is that over all this time suffering with these terrible diseases, Europeans had developed sort of cultural practices that would isolate those who were sick.
Quarantine.
Right. And that didn't exist in the New World.
Right, because they just simply didn't have these kind of, they're called crowd diseases, diseases that can spread rapidly through crowds. And they basically didn't exist in the Americas. You know, there's a long list of diseases that went across the Atlantic from Europe and Africa to the Americas. And there's a very short list of diseases that went the other way. Syphilis is the big one. And so what happened during this was that people would get hit by one or another member of this onslaught. And because they were unfamiliar with these kind of diseases, they wouldn't quarantine the victims. Instead, they would be taken to the center of the village or the town or whatever. The friends, the relatives, the neighbors would come and, you know, comfort them. They would all get infected. The entire village would get infected. People would freak out because they would think that something was going terribly wrong here, and they would race off to the next town to seek shelter. And in this way, they would bring the diseases with them, and these diseases exploded like chains of firecrackers from village to village to village across the Americas. And one of the striking things when you read some of the first European accounts is that they're constantly coming into areas where they've never been before, but the diseases have preceded them. I was raised in the Pacific Northwest, and the first European account of that is from Vancouver expedition, and they recount coming to the Puget Sound, which is where Seattle is, and all the coastal villages were empty. There were cemeteries, and they'd find skeletons all over the place, and it looked like a catastrophe had just happened there. And in fact, it had, through this wonderful sort of detective work. A historian in your neck of the woods, now at Duke, Elizabeth Fenn, really chronicled how a smallpox epidemic swept through the West in the 1770s and 1780s and came to the Puget Sound just before Vancouver got there.
Talk about some of the species that Columbus and the people who followed him brought with them deliberately. They brought things like wheat. They brought, as you mentioned, domesticated animals. What else did they have on board?
Well, the full panoply of European endeavors. So they brought, things that seem really strange to us, like silk. I mean, they tried to grow silkworms and mulberry trees. They tried to grow things like wine grapes in the Caribbean. They brought wheat. They brought bananas. They brought oranges. They brought all kinds of grasses because there were very few grasses in the New World. They brought, as you said, the domestic animals. They brought honeybees. Honeybees had a huge impact. They brought apples. They brought peaches. They brought all kinds of fruit. I mean, the list is just really enormous. And it went the other way, too. Incredible as it may seem, there were no tomatoes in Italy before Columbus. There were no chilies in Thailand or China before Columbus. There were no potatoes in Ireland. There were no sweet potatoes anywhere in the world. There was no corn in Africa. All of these came from the Americas. So there's this enormous interchange that really shaped the planet. And one of the arguments in this book that I wrote, 1493, is that historians have increasingly come to recognize that Columbus's event, Columbus's journey, was as much a biological event as it was a political and economic one. And it really marks the beginning of globalization, the time when, you know, things from one part of the earth can have an almost immediate impact on another part of the world, and the entire world is drawn into a single web of commerce.
Yeah, and using that as a lens to think about globalization even today is fascinating because it's true. Fantastic things happen and absolutely horrific things happen, and there's no separating one from the other.
No. And so people often ask me, you know, am I for or against globalization? And, you know, globalization has been around for, you know, hundreds of years now. And to be for or against it is like being for or against gravitation.
You know, it doesn't really matter if you're for or against it. It's happening.
It's part of our world. You know, I start the book by describing my little garden. Mm-hmm. I'm an avid, if incompetent, gardener. I live in western Massachusetts, and one day I was planting, you know, my tomatoes and zucchini. It occurred to me that there wasn't a single thing that I was planting in my garden, or for that matter, any of my neighbors planting in their garden, that originated within 3,000 miles of where we lived. You know, that this thing that I thought of as my homey little garden was, in fact, an exotic, cosmopolitan, modern object. It was part and parcel of globalization. And if I was to be anti-globalization, I would somehow be, you know, anti my own garden. It was just sort of striking to me. And I thought, how did all this happen? How did it get to be normal that, you know, parsley from the Middle East, tomatoes from Mexico, zucchini or potatoes from the Andes, zucchini from wherever zucchini is from, you know, got to be in my Massachusetts garden.
So it's one thing when we can transplant a species and things go well. Occasionally, though, without natural predators, an introduced species can literally run rampant in an environment.
Well, the American South has got a couple big examples of that. Kudzu, mm-hmm. which as a person from the Pacific Northwest, the first time I went to the Southeast and saw kudzu, I just simply couldn't believe it.
Yeah. What is this stuff growing all over everything?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I saw it literally over houses and over power lines and so forth. The odd thing is when you go to Japan, you see kudzu along the roads, and it looks nothing like the kudzu in the United States. There's something there that keeps it down. It's this harmless little ground cover, and it got to the United States, and whatever keeps it down in Japan does not exist here. And then, in fact, this is part of a larger phenomenon called ecological release, which is often when you transplant a species out of its home environment, the pests and predators that keep it down there are not transplanted with it, and it goes completely crazy in the new environment. Another example of that, also all through the South, is the fire ant.
Yeah. Right?
The Argentine fire ant, which is from there's a Rio Plata, that river that's in the northern part of Argentina, and it was transplanted, landed in Mobile, Alabama, accidentally somewhere in the 30s, and is now, you know, basically the ant that's eating most of the southern United States.
My guest is Charles C. Mann. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, for Science, and for Wired magazine. We're talking about his book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. The book is out now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles C. Mann. We're talking about his book, which is now out in paperback. It's called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Charles, we will talk about the gold and silver wealth that Europeans were hoping to discover and, in fact, did. But one pleasant surprise for them, at least at the time, was this stuff called tobacco that they just couldn't get enough of.
Yeah, it was originally from the Amazon, and, of course, native people really liked it. You find tobacco use all over the Americas. At the time, the kind of tobacco that they smoked is different than what we smoke today. It's much more potent. It's a kind of hallucinogen. Europeans discovered that this was this new way of getting high, and they really liked it. And tobacco has this, it's an incredibly terrific product if you think about it. It's extremely fun, it's extremely cool, and it's addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And so its use exploded over the world. And between about 1580 and about 1615, you find tobacco, which formerly was confined to a relatively small portion of the world, it pops up in places as diverse as Tokyo, China, the Ottoman Empire, all over Europe. You find the Pope reprimanding priests for smoking during Mass. it's an incredible thing. It's the world's first global commodity craze, and it sets the pattern for so many since then.
So you have this amazing demand for this product that people literally cannot get enough of. To the extent that European ships coming over, there weren't too many people yet with whom to trade in the New World. So they would send over ships. They couldn't send them entirely empty. So they would send over ships filled with soil for ballast.
Right, with rocks and stones and soil. And then they would belly up to Jamestown in Virginia or to the Caribbean. And what they would do is dump out the ballast and load in all these barrels of tobacco, which are incredibly heavy. And in my part of the world, where I live in New England and in Virginia, it had a big impact that we've only begun to understand now, because that soil almost certainly contained earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of the Ice Age, all the earthworms underneath the ice and then in the cold areas a few hundred miles south were wiped out. And so the top third of the United States had no earthworms at the time. And in the thousands of years since the ice retreated, they hadn't been repopulated by earthworms. Because earthworms, one of the earthworm researchers I talked to put it this way, he said, they don't have a lot of get up and go.
They're not traveling far.
If you have a little city backyard, and when an earthworm is born in it, it will never leave that backyard.
Yeah.
They just don't move around that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hadn't recolonized these areas. And the result is that in this large swath of North America, an entire ecosystem had arisen that didn't depend on earthworms, which are these incredible natural engineers, recycling nutrients into the soil. And so what earthworms do is, when the trees lose their leaves and that sort of thing, it piles up into what's called leaf litter on the ground. And earthworms essentially eat that leaf litter, go down in the ground, and excrete it in the form of worm castings. And that's how they enrich the soil, and they make the soil porous and do all the things that gardeners like. Well, if you had plants that didn't like that, that weren't used to that, what happens when earthworms are introduced is they take all the nutrients and stick them underground where the plants don't know where they are.
Hmm.
And so there's this massive, slow evolutionary change that's been taking place in New England and places like Minnesota and the Middle West, where plants that don't really like earthworms are being replaced by plants that do, and that includes lots and lots of underbrush plants. It includes things like sugar maples, which as young trees are very dependent on these sort of leaf litter for nutrition. And so much has been changed in this very slow way that, in fact, there's now campaigns in places like my state in Massachusetts where people are trying to keep worm-free areas. There's a Minnesota worm watch. There's an Alberta worm watch where they try to put up signs, that say to fishermen, don't dump your worms and this sort of thing. I don't know how successful it's going to be, but it's a part of this thing that I talk about in the book, which is that Columbus initiated this kind of slow motion ecological experiment that is transforming our world to this very day.
So Europeans came over here and, like the natives they encountered, realized there was a lot of really incredible, fertile land in North and South America. They wanted a piece of that. What ultimately led them to import slave labor rather than simply coming over with their own people and working the land?
This is an absolutely fascinating question, and it's one that, to my surprise, Adam Smith spent a lot of time worrying about in The Wealth of Nations, that great book that he wrote that's the kind of the foundation of modern economics.
Yeah.
And Smith pointed out, and discusses it three or four times, that he couldn't understand why slavery existed. He pointed out that Europeans had an institution for bringing over labor. It's called indentured servants. And the deal with indentured servants is it was very expensive to ship people across the ocean. So if you were a tobacco farmer or rice grower in Carolina or a sugar farmer in the Caribbean, you wanted labor. So what you would do is you would pay some very poor for the passage for some very poor person in, you know, in England, and they would come over and work for you for 4 to 7 years, and then after that they would be free to start their own plantation. And this institution, as Smith pointed out, worked very well for centuries.
In Europe.
In Europe. Mm-hmm. And it worked so well in the United States and initially that somewhere between half and two-thirds of the first British, you know, the first people who came to what is now the United States were indentured servants. And then suddenly, in the 1670s, 1680s, 1690s, it more or less stops and slavery starts. And Smith couldn't understand this. He said, no, wait a minute. Look at these slaves. They don't speak your language. You can't communicate with them. They're from, you know, some tropical area in Africa. They don't know how to grow your kind of crops. They're used to growing palms and things like that. And what's worst of all, they don't want to work for you. You've taken away their liberty. What they want to do is kill you, right?
Yeah.
So why would you take them as opposed to indentured servants who speak your language, know what you want, and also aren't going to kill you because there's this deal. You've signed this contract. He couldn't understand it. And eventually he said, well, slavery exists because people are wicked, which is true. I mean, people can be wicked. But now we know that there might be a little bit more to that because when Europeans came over, they brought over malaria. And southeast England and, you know, much of the Netherlands and so forth, all these wet areas of Europe had a kind of malaria called vivax malaria. And then soon after, a second type of malaria came with the very first Africans called falciparum. And what they did is they made much of the United States south of what is now the Mason-Dixon line, very interestingly, into a malaria zone. And there, when Europeans came, because most of them came from areas that weren't malarial, they would have to go through a process of what's called seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And what that meant is that when you brought over your indentured servant, you'd have to wait for a year, maybe even 2 years, to find out if they were going to survive malaria, because malaria makes you sick for months and months and months.
Right. So even if they do survive, ultimately, you've lost a lot of labor there.
You've lost a lot of labor. And they had death rates, because it was untreatable then, of between 40 and 70%.
Hmm.
So suddenly, now, think about Africans. The Africans come from West Africa, where malaria has been so long that literally there have been genetic changes in people from those areas. There's a kind of thing called Duffy, and the Duffy negativity, which is a sort of change in the slight change in the red blood cell that makes it hard for the malaria parasite to get inside, which is what it does. That means that West Africans are almost totally immune to vivax malaria, which is the first kind of malaria I mentioned. And then there's another phenomenon called sickle cell anemia, which is another change in the blood system that makes it hard for malaria. And that makes you, it's very complicated, but maybe you could say it makes you sort of half immune to falciparum malaria. But the end result is that people from West Africa are more immune to malaria than anybody else in the world. And the great historian Philip Curtin was really the first to calculate this. He looked at the parliamentary reports in England on the death rates of colonists and soldiers who were sent to places like the Caribbean and to West Africa. And he found that there's a tenfold difference between Africans in service there and Europeans. In some parts of Africa, a European who was sent there had somewhere between a 50% and 66% chance of dying within the first year from malaria and yellow fever. And so he calculated that basically Africans were somewhere between 3 and 4 times more likely to survive. And so this puts a big thumb on the scale. What it means is that even though the Africans are terrible workers because they want to kill you, it's a lot better to have a bad worker than a dead worker.
Hmm.
And so let's assume for the sake of argument that you're, you know, a totally unscrupulous person who doesn't really care about the morality of it. You'll look at it and you start to say to yourself, you know what? I'm going to have Africans.
Hmm.
And this gives this powerful impetus to the slave trade.
And as it turns out, there were in West Africa plenty of native people who were more than willing to gather up their countrymen and send them off to be enslaved.
Oh, yeah.
In the
New World. One of the things that I grew up was seeing was the movie, was the TV series Roots.
Sure.
Do you recall? And the very first show, there's this powerful scene in which a group of, I think they're English people, but I can't remember. Anyway, they're your English people or Americans, go into some village where I think his name is Kunta Kinte is, and they raid all these Africans and drag them screaming back to the ship. And this basically never happened. We're talking about Africa as if it's a single country, which it's not. It's, you know, dozens, it's a huge place. It's dozens and dozens of countries. And in all those places, there's lots of POWs and that sort of people that the state was happy to sell because they were their enemies, in the same way that French people would have more than likely been happy to sell Germans.
Yeah.
And so it's a big mistake to sort of picture Africans as these hapless, passive victims. They had, you know, tremendous force in all this, and it was very important. Africans are not a single unified group any more than Europeans were at the time. They thought of themselves, you know, Congolese or what have you, and they were selling their enemies. And so as a result, you know, there was a European demand, but there is an African supply and an entire supply of Africans willing to do it. So much so, and because of their immunities, they were so good at it, that by the end of the slave trade, you know, something like a third of the crews on the slave ships were Africans.
Talk about this, Charles. I think a lot of people, we think about culture in the New World in North and South America, and we think, okay, it's a blend of European culture and native culture. But in fact, there was a significant impact and remains a significant impact from African culture mixing with those other two.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, up to about 1820, which is, you know, from sort of 1492 to 1820, which is the majority of the history, you know, of Europeans contact, you know, being in America, up to that period, I haven't said this very well, but you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
Almost four times as many Africans came to the Americas as Europeans.
Hmm.
So demographically, what you're looking at is not, we think of it as, you know, Europeans coming over, but demographically what was important, the two majority populations were native people who were dying off but still represented a huge number of people, and Africans. It was the meeting of Native America and Africa with Europeans playing, in this regard, a peripheral role.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Daniel in Addison. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great. I'm a landscaper, so this is very fascinating to me. And just as an aside, I've been working for this couple for the last few months, the Boyds, and I just came to find out a couple of weeks ago that they're your parents. They're like the most delightful people. But anyhow,
thank you. They are delightful.
Delightful. So my question is, there's a band that has, you know, disbanded, but they have a song called Smallpox Champion, and it basically outlines that the fact that the colonizers at the time used smallpox deliberately to eradicate the native population. And I wonder if you have any information on that and whether that's the case. I've read a good portion of Germs, Guns, and Steel, and that informed me that that's probably the case, but I wonder what you had to say about it. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
There were certainly efforts to use smallpox deliberately, but that's just not very important in the historical scheme of things.
Hmm.
It was the inadvertent use of smallpox was far more important. I actually live in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is named after Lord Geoffrey Amherst, who is sometimes, you know, identified as the pioneer of biological warfare because he approved a plan to try and get rid of some native people that way. And as in most cases, I mean, it was the whole thing was completely horrendous, but it actually wasn't very effective.
Hmm.
So you don't want to give any of these people points for humanitarian motives, but it just really wasn't that important.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Todd in Blue Mound. Hi, Todd.
Hi, thank you. My part-time business is importing and exporting aquarium plants and some small animals and crayfish and different things. But I was wondering, is there any record from that early date of aquatic, you know, switchovers from continental? We run into the same problem right now with people who let their plants that they had in their aquarium out into the ponds, and they've taken over now. And I didn't know if there was a record of the 1493 voyage of anything where aquatic plants or fish or anything being brought.
There's quite a few sort of scattered records of efforts to do things like, you know, transplant trout and this sort of stuff. But the great bulk of these things happened then as now in the ballast of ships. Where ships would get have both things like barnacles and so forth on the outside, and then inside they get filled with water, and they would be at the end of a long trip, the water would be dumped out, and so you get records of, in places like the James River, European species appearing as early as the 17th century. There's a terrific museum in Jamestown that talks something about this.
We've talked so far only peripherally about the involvement of Asians in changing the New World, but certainly they were a major factor as time went by.
I'm sorry, there is a buzz going on.
The role of Asians in this country in South America.
Yes, there is. They weren't as important as Africans, but Asians began appearing very quickly. Spain established its colony in Manila in 1571, and almost immediately started trading with China. And in this way, there's these two guys. In my book, I say that they're probably should be much more well-known than they are, named Legazpi and Urdaneta. And what they were able to do was what Columbus tried and failed to do, which is establish direct contact, commercial contact with China. And they did this.
Let me have you pause right there because we're going to take a break and I'll let you finish in just a moment. We are speaking this hour with Charles C. Mann about his book, now available in paperback, called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles C. Mann, correspondent for The Atlantic Science and Wired magazines. His book, available now in paperback, is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. You can join us at think@kera.org or 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Chris who writes, "We were aware that our ancestors were sold into slavery by other Africans, but your guest assumption that any people wouldn't scream being sold off, especially the women, whether captive or not, is repulsive." And I want to give you a chance, Charles, to clarify. You were not suggesting for a moment, I'm assuming, that slavery was not a horrible institution, however it came to be.
No, I actually don't understand that. What I was saying is not, I'm very sorry that she got the opinion. I actually don't really understand how she got it. But what I was trying to say is that the traditional picture, which you learn from Roots, which was of Europeans coming and doing these slaving bans, just simply didn't happen. And the reason is that Africa consisted of many well-organized societies that would have reacted to the presence of marauding bands of Europeans exactly the same way that European states would have reacted to the presence of marauding bands of Africans.
Okay,
it would not have been permitted. It wasn't permitted. And furthermore, the European trading stations, I mean, they were tiny. And what they did essentially was to transfer Africans who, for reasons of state, were being gotten rid of by African nations to Europe. Now, the other thing that's important to say in all of this is that slavery was an institution that existed around the entire world in every society. There were slaves in every European society. There were slaves in Asia. There were slaves in Africa. There were slaves in the Americas. It's, you know, we think of it through the prism of our history as being this uniquely African institution, but it wasn't by any means. And so what was striking about the transatlantic trade is its size and the fact that the slaves were treated as fungible units of labor. But the fact of slavery, the fact of state involvement in it, was completely something that had been characteristic of human society since the Code of Hammurabi.
Okay, let's go back to what we were talking about before the break, which was trade that was centered in the Philippines. And you mentioned these two guys, I guess they were cousins, Legazpi and Urdaneta.
Yes, and they established in Manila, they established the modern Spanish colony of Manila in 1571. And that's really the date that globalization begins, because they almost immediately begin trading silver from the Americas, which is mined by Africans for slaves, for silk, and for porcelain that's sent across the Pacific to Mexico City, where it's then passed on to Europe. The money is used to buy guns and horses, which are used to trade for Africans, which are used to mine. And this is the beginning of uniting the entire world in this loop of commerce. Mm. And as part of this, more and more Asians start coming to the Americas, so much so that there's a significant presence of Asians in Mexico City and Lima and the other major Spanish cities by the early 17th century.
And there was so much silver for a while that it actually, there was too much in Spain, and it became worth nothing or very little.
Well, it's not so much that. It's still, what happened is that, all the stuff that we're talking about, biology and ecology and all these species that come across, this is a very modern perspective. What was important from the European point of view was that in 1545, Europeans came across in southern Bolivia at what is as close to a mountain of pure silver as geology allows. It's called Potosi. And for a while, Potosi and the mines around it were the biggest city in the Americas and one of the biggest in the world. And an absolute river of silver poured out of this. And over the next couple hundred years, the world supply of precious metals doubled or even tripled, and the silver washed out of the New World. Hmm. And Europe, which had previously been a relatively poor part of the world, in fact, it was always trying to get to China and finding out when they did that they didn't have anything the Chinese wanted. It was like the Beverly Hillbillies. Suddenly they became immensely rich, and they went shopping, right? And the Chinese, who had been completely uninterested in Europe because it was too poor and unsophisticated to be worth bothering with, suddenly these guys start showing up with shiploads of money, with silver, and they become very interested. And the result is that Europe, as one historian put it, was able to, with the Spanish silver, was able to hitch a ride on the Chinese train.
I want to talk for a moment about the lowly potato, which in my family's history, sort of when we associate it with Europe, we think about the thing that died off and caused so many millions of Irish to emigrate to this country. But in fact, you make a really good case here for the reality that the potato probably saved a lot more European lives from starvation than it ultimately threatened in the 19th century.
Yes, the potato comes. And the deal with potatoes is that they're a tuber. And as you know, the good part grows underground. And this is a completely different architecture than something like wheat or rice or any of the cereals. Those plants, the head, the good part, grows at the top of a very thin stalk. And so if you're especially successful wheat farmer, rice farmer, which means that you have a lot of grain, you run the risk of something called lodging, which is that the plant falls over and dies. And so you're limited by the architecture of the plant. In fact, the Green Revolution, which is the big change in agricultural productivity that occurred in the middle of the last century, is essentially breeding plants, cereals that had shorter, tougher stalks that would allow you to have this increased grain. Well, tubers, by contrast, grow underground. And the result is they can get as big as you want to without having any problem for the architecture of the plant. And as a result, the average European or English farmer, say, was able to reap roughly four times as much what he called dry food matter out of an acre of potatoes than they could out of an acre of wheat or barley or rye or whatever else they were growing. And so the result is that you have a massive increase in food supply over this big swath of Europe that becomes the potato part of Europe, which goes all the way from the Ukraine to Ireland. And people just ate potatoes at a rate that's really hard to do to imagine now. There's a parliamentary inquiry into potatoes in the early 19th century that established that the average Irish working man in, I think this is about 1820, ate 12 pounds of potatoes a day.
How is that possible?
Well, they're working incredibly hard, right?
Yeah.
So they would eat these potatoes, and their diet, about 40% of the Irish, the only solid food they had was potatoes.
Hmm.
And they would eat potatoes and milk. And it turns out that that's actually completely nutritionally balanced. Nowadays, we're a little bit worried about carbs, but if you're, you know, an Irish working man, you're working insanely hard, and the issues with carbs don't really show up. What you want is calories, and potatoes and milk provide all the calories and all the essential nutrients that you need. Then what happens is another example of this phenomenon we've been talking about, the Columbian Exchange, is that one of the pests from South America, the potato late blight, Phytophthora infestans, comes in the 1840s, and it looks, and there's this spread of potatoes which are being grown as a monoculture, you know, as a single swath of a very few varieties called the lumper that are grown across this 2,000-mile area, and it looks and it sees an ocean of breakfast.
Hmm.
And in this extraordinary way, it explodes across Europe in the space of one summer, and so many poor people are so dependent on potatoes that roughly 2 million people die, and a million of them alone are in Ireland. But your ancestors are right when they think about the impact. Ireland was so badly affected that Ireland is maybe the only country in the world that has fewer people within the same boundaries now than it did 150 years ago.
Wow.
But so much of the rest of Europe was so strongly positively affected by the potato that the balance is probably positive even despite that. And the great French historian Fernand Braudel was probably the first to really put this together, and he assembled the data on the number of famines in Europe over a period of, you know, a number of centuries. And what he showed was that there were about, in France, for example, in the centuries prior to the potato, there was roughly 11 gigantic nationwide famines every 100 years.
Hmm.
So that's more than one a decade. And then hundreds and hundreds of local famines. The potato comes, and basically all of these famines stop. And the impact on Europeans is huge. Suddenly everybody has enough to eat. Suddenly the population starts to rise. Governments become stable because there are no longer food riots and, you know, armed guards around granaries and mobs of starving, hungry people around the countryside. And as the William McNeill, the historian, put it, potatoes are the fuel that made European empires possible. And, you know, if you happen to be in a bookstore and you want to get a one-volume history of Europe, you should, you know, pick it off the shelf and look in the back. And if there isn't an entry about potatoes in that index, forget it. Get a more modern book.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next on the phone with Adam in Fort Worth. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you doing? I love your show.
Thank you.
First-time caller.
Welcome.
I had a question. I know you've been talking about, like, exchanges between, you know, the Americas, you know, that had to do with fruit and Europe, both, you know, beneficial and not so much. But my question doesn't really have so much to do with that. It was, I know that when Christopher Columbus he wrote in his log something akin to he had met some natives and they grabbed his sword out of ignorance, and he said something like, with 150 men, we could easily subject them to, we could easily subject them and make them do whatever we want. My question is the second voyage was more militaristic. Did that have any precedent, you know, perhaps on the mindset of specifically the Spanish and the black legends that, the atrocities that happened later on? And, I mean, you know, obviously Christopher Columbus, when he met the Arawak people, didn't claim the high ground. However, morally or anything, But do you think that, you know, that sort of mindset and the second wave of Europeans that Christopher Columbus led over there to the New World had any sort of precedent for later actions to come?
What do you think, Charles?
Well, if I understand the question, you're saying, you know, did Columbus, you know, talking about enslaving people and pushing them around, set some kind of precedent? Is that?
That's my understanding of the question as well.
Yeah, and the answer is sort of not really, because on two levels. First, in general, European countries, like Asian countries, African countries, and for that matter, Indian empires, have been territorially expanding themselves, you know, going over and conquering other people, usually in the most awful way, for as long as there's been human history, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that this kind of aggression is something that's a hallmark of human history. And so for Spain in particular was shaped by this because it had been conquered for so long by Islamic empires. And for 700 years, the Spaniards had been slowly winning it back. And in fact, just before Columbus set off, they reconquered all of Spain. And then they start, you know, they had all these people who had spent their entire lives in military conquest. They needed to have something to do. And so they went and they did things like conquer the Canary Islands. All this in the period of time just before Columbus. So Columbus, in thinking about the military possibility of acquiring new territory, was really just in the mainstream of a very, very long and unfortunate human tradition.
Can you speak just briefly in this last minute that we have about how the ways that we do history and understand history are different today than they were even half a century ago?
Yes. Today we have a much richer understanding of the human enterprise and its place in the world. You know, the history that I grew up in, you know, as a kid, was really a story about great men and the great deeds they did in our, you know, sort of march towards progress. And while not saying for a moment that people shouldn't learn about great people and great deeds, we now know that there's lots of other parts about history as well. There's there's a history of the way men and women treat each other. There's a history of the way that we have interacted with our environment. There's a history of that environment itself. And we now know we have much richer understanding of all the different and complicated ways that people interact with each other and how these have changed over time. In addition, we have a history of interaction. Before, you learned about English history or American history or French history without realizing that they're all entangled with each other.
Charles C. Mann is a correspondent for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired magazines. His book, now available in paperback, is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Charles, really fascinating piece of work. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs. Also, download the podcast every day online at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.